Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 68, recorded the 27th of June, 2011.
Wow. I have to say wow because we have so many contributors today.
Which is lovely.
It's awesome. Feel the raw power and energy generated by so many contributors. Y'all feeling it? Okay. Oh.
I can feel it.
There you go. All right.
Okay.
Please keep it up, ladies and gentlemen. We love it.
They are for today, and we'll have to see. We may not actually get through all of these all this time.
Probably not through everything, but if we don't, we'll do some more next week.
Catch up next week.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean you should not send things in. Please keep doing that.
We love to hear from you.
Yeah, so don't hesitate at all.
So, we are hearing from today Stuart over in the UK and Andreka in Oregon. Mick, also from the UK, and Robert in Michigan, and Anne, and we don't know where Anne is from.
But she's new.
So that's great! Welcome, Anne, to the world of contributors. And David in Texas. So let's get started with Stuart.
Okay. Stuart had a question about his neon dwarf rainbows that just, two of them, not all of them, two of them just suddenly died, and this is the strange thing. Nothing was wrong. He was looking at his tank, everything was dandy, and then, strangely enough, he came back about an hour later and two of them were dead. Not only that, but nothing else was wrong with the tank. All the other fish were fine. The water parameters tested out okay. No issues.
Piscine homicide?
Maybe. I don't know. Or is that... I don't want to say piscicide. I don't know.
Piscicide?
What you'd call it. Something strange is going on.
Sorry, I don't mean to make light of his poor fishies.
No.
It just sounded like you were setting up for a crime scene investigation.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about it because, you know, rainbows are not prone to that I know of. I mean, I once had a bala shark that suddenly jumped up and hit its head on the glass and died. It was really weird.
That's a
just very suddenly.
Sad way to go.
Just rammed its head at the glass as fast as it could go. I don't know why, and nobody knows why, and all the other fish in the tank were fine.
Extreme sport bala sharks.
Yeah.
Tried to go surfing in the tank.
But if any of you have unexplained deaths that are similar to this one that can't be traced to anything and didn't result in any further deaths, let us know. Especially if they're rainbow fish, because maybe there's something going on here. But I don't know of anything, so just...
If anybody has any ideas...
Yeah, then please let us know.
Okay, Andreka.
Yeah, Andreka, on Facebook, we had a bit of an exchange about what was going on in her tank, and they had some issues with ick, it sounded like, and she's treating the tank with some salt, which is generally a good way to go, and even with salt-sensitive fish, if you're not nuts with the salt, then it can still be okay, because most fish can tolerate a wee bit. Some fish can tolerate a lot more than others. And we were talking about that because she's got cardinal tetras and corydoras, and, you know, there are differing opinions on how much salt they can tolerate and so on. But she's also going to put another heater in there and increase the temperature, and that's a good thing to do. But the good news, what they had, was that they found their Amano shrimp.
Yay!
That had seemed to disappear. And didn't we mention that in
the... He came back from wherever he was visiting.
Show once about we had a mono shrimp that had disappeared for months and suddenly reappeared. I think we've mentioned that in a show before. So, they seem to do that. It's interesting. But that's good that the shrimp is back, and salt certainly won't hurt a mono shrimp, as they, part of their reproductive cycle is in salt water, so that shouldn't be a problem. But that could be what's happening with the Java moss, really, then, if the shrimp's still there. So, there you go.
Okay, so... Now, we had mentioned this before, we are going to go over Mix from the UK, Mix Newts and his firebelly toads. He sent us a groovy write-up about with pictures and everything. We'll put the pictures up on the resource page. We had wanted to do a phone interview with him, but that's a little bit expensive from over there, so
yes.
He wrote it up for us.
So I'm going to go through his notes and kind of paraphrase and do some quotations, but this is all mixed stuff, so I can't claim any credit for it. We're just doing this in lieu of an interview. So, here we go. Oh, by the way, did we mention to check out the resources page? We're going to put his pics up that he sent of his newts.
Did I just say that?
Maybe you did.
I think
you did. It's Monday. My head is spinning.
Sorry, guys.
Okay. So, He said he wanted a new and challenge and an interesting living room show tank with a difference. And he certainly had that. It's very interesting. The pictures are really nice. You should check them out. They already have a 65-liter community tank in the living room with tetras, rasboras, corydoras, horse-faced loaches, barbs, and a male betta. So, that's they've already got tank. That's probably quite the striking showpiece by itself. So now they're doing something different in the living room.
They're going to have something completely different.
Yes. This is a paludarium. And as we've talked about before, a paludarium is when you have a land area and a water area in a glass box, basically. So, he wanted a good-sized beach or land area and decided to make the tank two-thirds water and one-third land. And he also wanted a waterfall that was part of the filter system. So
I like those.
Yeah. Yeah, they look cool. And I've done that before, and they're fun. A long time ago. Should do it again sometime. He's got... This is an interesting idea. I've never really heard of doing this before. He used multi-cell plant trays turned upside down to allow the water current to flow and avoid anaerobic pockets and reduce the cost of the gravel bank. So that is the land area.
Okay, multi-cell plant trays.
Yes.
So, like, you go to the hardware store and you buy a pony pack of strawberry plants and you use that kind of thing? Is that what he means?
I think it's sort of like that. I think it's one that holds a lot of...
Of starts plants. Of a plant.
I don't know how many he used, though, but it's interesting. That's kind of what I'm visualizing. They call them pony packs here, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you buy a lot of plants in them.
Okay.
I'm sure he used empty ones, so he wouldn't have to worry about pesticides and whatnot.
Right.
But not ones that had been used and then washed out.
How would you get a hold of ones that are not been used yet? Because don't they arrive at the hardware store already full?
Well, that's a good question.
Maybe you can get them in a gardening supply?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe Mick's got connections.
Maybe he's got connections. He knows somebody. And then he put moss on top of it to make it soft for the newts' bellies, which is a good idea. And then the moss, you know, it can grow as long as it's wet.
Can we have moss? We'll just put moss in our room. It'll be soft for my belly.
It'll be an interesting bedspread. Okay. And then he added three large, quote, spidery, unquote, bogwood pieces.
No, it's bogwood.
Bogwood is driftwood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's just in the UK, they usually call it bogwood.
Do they usually pull it out of a bog instead of the ocean?
Probably. A lot of times, driftwood is called driftwood in the US even when it doesn't come from the ocean.
That's true.
Which is kind of silly because it doesn't really drift a whole lot if it's sitting out in a, you know,
a lake
on the bottom or something. It's not drifting. But that's what they call it anyway in the US. But in the UK, it's usually bogwood.
Driftwood sounds better than previously waterlogged wood.
Right. But I like bogwood. It's kind of cool.
Bogwood
it's a good way to
good.
Say it.
As and long as you don't pull any bog people out of those bogs.
No.
You don't want to put that in your fish tank.
No, that would be unpleasant.
Yeah.
And so the tallest of these pieces of bogwood acts as a waterfall, and he's got a 55-liter per hour powerhead pump that has a flexible outflow tube that forms the waterfall. And the powerhead is mounted on dual sponge filter base with a lava rock pile to disguise the filter sponges. Good idea. And provide additional area for bacterial filtration. Another good idea. At the intake point and make an additional raised island area. So that's cool. I like that. I'm envisioning that. And then he planted the land area with a couple of ferns and a couple of spider plants.
Ferns are lovely.
So are spider plants. I'm rather partial to both.
Yes, they are.
And in the water, he has two moss balls. And you're probably talking about like Marimo moss balls. Like that Japanese moss that grows in balls because it's rolled around at the bottom of the lake by the wave action.
Oh, cool.
Naturally forms balls, but you can also roll it up yourself. A clump of Java moss and a small clump of Nutella. Well, I never see Nutella these days.
Nutella, not Nutella.
Nutella. You can get that in Europe, too, and it's good. But you
yeah,
can get it here
that's
now anyway.
That's tasty.
So, yeah, it's good stuff.
But you don't want to put it in your fish tank.
No. And he's thinking of putting some Anubias in the water and some air plants to the higher bogwood pieces.
Ooh,
Tillandsias.
That would be neat.
Yeah, maybe some Spanish moss would be one of those air plants. I don't know. That's great stuff. I love air plants. I ordered some from a catalog in a magazine when I was a kid and kept them in my windowsill for a long time.
What did you attach them to? Just your windowsill?
Wood.
Oh. Sorry.
See,
comment about day of the week earlier.
Okay. Well, You can actually glue them to a refrigerator magnet if you watch yourself.
Really?
Right. Yeah, I've seen them sold that way. Not
wow.
the best thing, but they can survive for some time that way. They're pretty hardy. Anyway, I'm getting off track. And as tank mates, he has four purple striped apple snails, which are quite beautiful. I liked them.
They have purple apple snails?
Remember the picture that I showed you?
I'll have to see it again.
You have to see it again. They're beautiful.
We'll show that picture, though. Purple ones.
Yeah. And two horned zebra nerite snails. Those are cool, too. Mm-hmm. I like those. And a few adult cherry shrimp from my breeding colony.
Cherry shrimp are beautiful, too.
Yeah. I've got a question. I'm wondering if the newts are going to nick off a few of the shrimp. I mean, I'm sure they'd get small ones, but can they get the adults? I don't know. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Seems like they try. Anyway.
How big do fire-bellied newts get?
Oh, about yay big.
Including the... Oh, yeah, that was helpful. You guys all know how big they get.
Yes. I'm not sure exactly. I think that it's probably around 6 inches or so.
Including the tail.
Yeah, I had a...
The tail about half of that, maybe 3 inches tail.
Yeah, probably about that. That's ballpark figures, folks. The tank is filled with 20 liters of water. It's about 5 gallons, isn't it? No, not exactly, but somewhere around there. With... Displacement for decor gives a water level of 4 inches, and there's a 50-watt heater added, but this is set to 20 Celsius and hardly ever comes on at this time of the year. Imagine not. And he allowed the setup to run unpopulated for 2 days to test the power head and set pipe for the waterfall flow, which is a great idea.
Some cycling going.
Well, it's good to start. You'd start a cycle if you got some waste in there, some ammonia to start the cycle, but you wouldn't finish it in 2 days. But the nice thing is you're testing out how everything's working. Mm-hmm. And looking and making sure the system, like the power head and so on, are stable. And so that's good. It's hard to resist the temptation to put something in right away when you're done, but I'm glad he did that for 2 days. That's the best way to do
good.
It. That's good. And then the newts themselves. And he says there are two types of fire-bellied newts commonly sold, and you can jump in if you want to.
Jump in what? The tank?
Yes. The Chinese and Japanese varieties. I think I had the Japanese variety when I was a kid. I was quite young at the time, 13 or so, I think. They are almost identical, both the Chinese and the Japanese, but the Japanese are slightly larger and with a rougher skin. The main body color is browny green, but adults have a faint red edge to the spine and tail.
Mm.
The bellies are bright red in juveniles. Quite striking. And the pattern becomes slightly spread and blotchy as they grow. I remember that. So much like a fire-bellied toad, if you've seen those.
No, fire-bellied toads that I've seen, the grown-ups still looked pretty bright on the belly.
Yes. Yeah, well, the adults are still bright. They're just not plain red.
Oh, they don't have the little black spots on them when they're juveniles?
The newts don't. They just have a red belly.
Oh, okay.
That's my understanding of how it works. And Mick has the Japanese species, Synops pyrogaster. Pyrogaster meaning fire-bellied.
That's a cool name.
And Synops... I'm not sure what that means.
Unless,
ops means
eyes. Of course,
it would
be referring to indigestion, and then it wouldn't be so fun.
Might mean blue eyes. I'm not sure. And he said he found one large adult newt at the local reptile shop, and it was about 5 inches long. And he thinks it's a male, as its tail is long, and the female's tails are shorter in proportion. And then he found 3 juveniles at a large aquatic shop, around 3 inches long. He got those as well, and he would have preferred to have them all the same size. But he figured they all had a lot of hiding places, so we might as well try it. And then...
And really, you kind of take what the pet store's got, so...
Yeah, you gotta do what you gotta do, sometimes. And he soon discovered they are very active and interesting pets, which is good, because there are some salamanders that just don't do a whole lot. They just...
Oh, can we bring up ours?
Yes, we can bring up ours.
Okay, we don't have them anymore. This was many years ago. In fact, Russ got him when we were dating and then engaged.
Yes. Someone brought him over to the house because he had fallen down their window well.
Yes.
And they knew I would appreciate him.
And he was one of those guys that just liked to... You know, like Ferdinand the Bull in that cartoon, that old Disney cartoon, you know, just sit and smell the flowers.
He was a bit like that.
He was a bit like that. We named him Commodious Rump because he
just
never
sat around
did
on his
anything.
Rear end all day. And... Except when we were feeding him, then he got really excited.
But it was fun because he had a very fun name to say.
Yes,
he wasn't a newt, though. He was a salamander.
He was a tiger salamander.
He was a tiger salamander.
They live around here. And he was excited to be fed, and that was about it.
That was about it.
So,
but we loved him anyway.
I think we should take a break just about now, don't you think?
This isn't a commercial because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay, ready? We're back!
Woohoo!
So, we were talking about... We need to get back on track and talk about the
newts. We were talking about Commodius rump, okay. And now we are going to go back to the newts.
Yes. And he was saying they are very active through the day and spend about half their time in the water and half on land. And they're very good climbers. They can even get quite a way up the glass sides before gravity kicks in.
Now, do they have anything on their feet, their toes, like geckos do that help them climb, or are they just kind of sticky?
I think they're just kind of sticky. You get a little bit of adhesion just because they're wet. I think so. I think that's how it works.
Okay.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember them having any like suction cuppy sort of toes like tree frogs or anything like that. I don't think they do. Although there are some salamanders that do, but not fire-bellied newts. And he would recommend having a very good cover and filling any gaps with filter floss where the wires come in. Very good idea.
So they can't highly escape. Agree.
Yeah, so if you do need to have a gap, filter floss is one of those lovely things that fills in gaps. That's a good suggestion. It says that they feed on anything they can get, and he tends to feed them every 3 days with either bloodworm, adult brine shrimp, or frog pellets. And he keeps the main body of the tank with no substrate to avoid any accidental ingestion of gravel, and also to help keep things clean. That does make it easier.
So you only have to feed them every 3 days.
Mm-hmm. So that's nice. You need to go for a weekend somewhere. Just make sure
those
to
three things every 3 days, or he just feeds them every 3 days.
I think he just feeds them every 3 days, and he alternates those when he feels like it.
Okay.
I think that's what he means, and I think that sounds good.
That's kind of nice. If they don't need it all the time, then if you forget one day, it's okay.
Yeah. You could go out on a weekend and not worry about them.
So that might be kind of nice in an office, actually.
Yeah, a good office pet. There you go.
We'll do that next time, huh?
There you go. And they seem to have poor eyesight, and they snatch at food only when it is right in front of them. And he says, I'm very keen to try to feed the larger newt away from the others, as I have seen him nip at a passing tail when food is there. Huh. So, that's a good idea. Like, you don't want to feed turtles of different sizes together either, because one might nip off the other's head. I am hoping to see if I can get them breeding as they all mature. To do this, I will need to remove the heater and let them have a cool period in the winter. Yeah, a lot of amphibians
it's kind
and reptiles.
Of a seasonal cue.
Yeah, brumation. They like that cooler period for a while to simulate the winter and stimulate some
springtime activity.
Yeah, springtime activity when things warm up. It says, I do a 5-liter water change every week with conditioned water for my fish room, which I allow to cool for a couple of hours before I use it. I have to be careful not to take too much water out and dry dock the water pump. That would be bad. All in all, a very interesting and satisfying project, and the newts are great fun to watch. My idea now is to add 3 fire-bellied toads to the mix for a really interesting angle, but that's a whole new story. And actually, we got an email from him afterwards.
Yeah.
He actually did go pick up the toads. So I'm interested in how
very pretty toads.
That will go, yeah. Yeah, fire-bellied toads are lovely. I was wondering how they do together. I've heard conflicting reports. Some people say, yeah, they're fine. Other people say, no, never do it. You know, so let us know how that goes. That's interesting. And thank you, Mick, for your spotlight that you provided us with. We will, as I said, put your pictures up on the resources page, and we're just glad to have it. It's something that I don't have a lot of recent experience with, so it's nice to be able to do that. This is just what we've been asking for, you know. People
perfect.
Send us things like this, and it's perfect. So, there we go.
So, now we are going to move on. Robert has some questions.
Yes, Robert sent in a couple of questions. One was about UV sterilizers, and the other one was about chlorine. So, let's talk a little bit about those. He was mentioning that in his tank, he recently got something that looked kind of like algae. He was figuring that it was algae. It was sort of greenish, although when it came out of the tank, it seemed to be sort of whitish. And this is a kind of puzzling to me what's going on. I'm kind of confused. But, so I would say, it might be good to see what's been changing in your tank lately, to see if you can figure out what this is, because it could be, even if a UV might be a good idea, it's probably better to pin down what's going on, what caused this, just in case we have some other issue that we need to deal with that the UV may not be dealing with. So, have you had any changes in your aquarium lately? Did your bulbs recently expire? Or is light from the windows coming in? Something like that. Is any of that going on? Sometimes when the photo period changes in the summer and the angles of the light changes in the summer, you get algae growing in a tank where there was none before, and it's just because a little bit of sunlight's getting in, or, you know, things like that. I mean, you've probably thought of all this already, but are there nutrients that are different in the tank? Have you changed food recently? Is there something going on? So think about those things, too, because there may be something that needs to be... This is usually a symptom of an issue rather than an issue itself. When algae suddenly blooms in the tank.
Algae blooms.
Exactly. So let's... I'd just suggest maybe look into those things. But as far as UV sterilizers go, a couple of things, also called UV clarifiers, of course. I don't have any direct experience with them. I've looked into them on various occasions, just as my duty as an aquarist and of my curiosity to try to figure out, you know, why people use them and so on. So I've looked into them a bit. I don't have a lot... to say about it, unfortunately, because I don't know very much, and I admit that freely. But, a couple of things. One, if you do get one, pay careful attention to the size and what rating it has for the gallons per hour and so on, because the dwell time and the size and all these things relate to each other. It's possible to have a UV sterilizer in a tank that is doing an admirable job in terms of functioning within itself. But it might not be working fast enough to keep up with whatever's growing in the tank if it's not the right size.
Explain to us what dwell time is.
Dwell time is how long the water with the little wee beasties, whether they be algae or bacteria or viruses or whatever, go through and actually pass through the UV light inside the unit.
How long they stay.
And how long their exposure is. It's like exposure time to the UV light.
Do you want that higher then?
Well,
like a longer dwell time?
There are different things because the flow rate and the length of the light and the shape of the tubes that go around the light, all of those things can modify dwell time. But basically, they'll be rated for particular gallonages and so on, and it's just important to pay attention to that. Because if you get one that's it's not rated for your tank size, it may or may not do a very good job depending on your bioload and so on. Another thing to keep in mind, of course, I'm sure you know this, that the bulb does need to be changed periodically because like fluorescent lights, you know, you lose potency after a while, basically. It's a lot less functional light comes out of it after a certain period of time, so keep up with that, of course. And then, depending on the type of filter, you'll need to consider if it's an inline or an in-tank one. Again, I don't have any direct experience with that, but just... Those are some things to think about when you're getting one. I've heard great things about them. I've heard that they do clarify water very well. I've heard that they can also help treat things that are otherwise difficult to treat, like piscine tuberculosis, because the bacteria are all floating in the water and they're reinfecting healthy fish if there's a sick fish in the tank and so on. And one of the only ways to keep it under control is to use a UV sterilizer. So they do have their place, and if that works for you, let us know what your experience is with it. Now, let's talk about your next question, which was about chlorine and chloramine. He had several questions about this. Robert wanted to know, first of all, well, there's several things here that we need to make sure we cover. What does chlorine do to fish? Is it something that's immediate? Is it slow acting? And how do you remove it from the water? What's the most effective way to make sure that your fish are protected from it? So let's see if we can address that, maybe not necessarily in that order, but... Okay, chlorine and chloramine are, of course, different. Chlorine is something that's been used in municipal water supplies for a long time because it kills bacteria, of course. Chloramine is more recent. It's still been around a while, but much more recent than chlorine. And basically, it's chlorine bound with ammonia to not get too chemically... You know, technical. It's chlorine and ammonia bound together. The differences in how they function is that chlorine will dissipate if it's sitting in water for a certain period of time.
You just kind of evaporate.
Set it out. Yeah, it evaporates. If you heat the water, you stir the water, it'll evaporate more quickly. If you agitate it, you know, something like that, aerate it, it'll dissipate more quickly, but it eventually dissipates in a day or so, 24 hours. Chloramine does not dissipate very readily. So you can, you know, let your water sit out for a day or two and you'll still have chloramine in it. So, that's part of the reason they use it, is because it's more persistent in the water, and there, I suppose, are other reasons too. But if you put a dechlorinator that's just a dechlorinator in water that's been treated with chloramine, it'll take care of the chlorine, but ammonia will be in the water, which of course is not a good thing. That's toxic to the fish, of course. Fortunately, most aquarium water conditioners do handle both these days, so you really don't have to worry about that, as long as you check on the label and it says that it will handle chloramines. Now, the chlorine, what does it do to the fish, and is it immediate or slow-acting? How does it work? Well, chlorine molecules, we're going to be kind of basic here, but they are like bleach in a lot of ways. They cause cellular damage, and we're not going to get into that too much. I don't know a whole lot of the specifics myself, but if they contact the fish's tissues, they're going to cause damage to the cells. And this is most critical in the most sensitive parts of the fish. The fish is covered with a slime coat and with scales. They could handle a limited amount of chlorine in the water without too much damage, but it's the gills where it really gets them. The gills, of course, are very critical for respiration because that's the main organ of respiration for the fish. And chlorine to fish in the water is like chlorine gas to us, only the fish are more sensitive. If you go to the pool and you smell chlorine in the water, you know that's not going to kill you. It might give you a headache after a while, but it's not going to kill you right off. But since they're right in the water and they're breathing it, it's going past their gills and it's damaging their gills, even in fairly small quantities that when we drink it, we can't even smell chlorine, but it can kill them. And the amount of damage varies with the amount of chlorine or chloramine in the water. And the kicker is that these amounts vary with the water source, they vary with the seasons, they vary with the municipal system conditions. So, for example, if they have to do work on the pipes one day and they think they might have a higher bacterial count in the water because of dirt that got in the pipes, they might dump a lot more chlorine in the water or chloramines in the water that day or for the next week. And so that can be pretty dangerous. And you have to worry about that. So one of the most important things is just be aware that in different times, different seasons, that your system might switch from chlorine to chloramine depending on the season and so on. There, you just have to be prepared. So what is best is probably just running the water into a holding tank, circulating it, and adding purifier that takes care of both chlorines and chloramines, and heat it to the specifications of your aquarium. I think some people do that. Some people need to do that because of various situations that they have going on. But that's probably the best and the safest thing to do. I'll tell you what I usually do, though. I've had pretty decent tap water, so I just add the tap water add the conditioner while I'm adding tap water to the aquarium from my Python. So that's how I change water. I use a Python, I approximate the temperature, run it into the tank, and just add the appropriate amount of dechlorinator. The fish seem perfectly content with this. They're usually excited after they have a water change. The fish spawn with that, the fry grow up, it seems to be fine. And I operate on 20 to 35% water changes per week, and that has not been an issue. But that's maybe not the best way to do it, but there are some people, and myself included, who have done changes where if the water is 20, the water changes 20% or less, they don't even add a conditioner. I've done that. I don't do it anymore. I used to. But when I became aware that changes can happen, suddenly your water supply company dumps more chlorine in the water. And this is something I heard from the Bailey brothers and Pet Fish Talk, actually, that some people going on that regimen suddenly had a huge amount of chlorine dumped in their system because of some issue in the municipal water supply, and then the fish all died. That's why I do it mostly as insurance, because I've done it the other way without any issues, but I just do that now just to be careful. Okay.
Okay, we are just about out of time, and we have several other things. Perhaps we should save those for next time.
I think we need to talk about end setup at least, and a little bit about David's, and then we'll pause there.
So we're not going to save it for next week, saying.
If that's okay, just a little bit. Just a little bit more. It'll be a little bit longer this time, but that's okay. Now, what have we got?
Anne told us about her setup. She says she's been enjoying the podcast on her commute home, which is nice. Russ used to... Well, he still does. On the bus, he listens to various podcasts on commute, too. And she wanted to ask advice about getting rid of some small invasive snails that she has in a heavily planted tank. She says, I'm not sure what type they are, but they are prolific and are eating up my leafy plants. I was thinking about getting assassin snails, but I am concerned that the assassins may eat fish eggs. I have breeding Australe orange killifish in my tank, and I wouldn't want to lose their eggs. Do you have any suggestions for getting rid of the snails?
Okay.
And she tells us what's in there. Should I go over that?
Sure.
It says she's got a 30-gallon tank with the killifish, tiger endlers, dwarf emerald rasboras, a poor lonely cardinal tetra, a mono shrimp, and a bamboo shrimp.
Okay. And it looks like she said she was thinking about getting a female betta to eat the snails, but she wasn't sure because she was thinking of adding German blue rams and that the colorful killifish and the endlers might not do that well with the betta. Okay. Well, I think, first of all, sounds like a nice setup, and I would say that one thing, check the snails. Look up this word on the internet if you can. Go to Google Images and try PHYSA. And
FISA?
FISA. See if the snails look anything like that. If they do, if they're that kind of snail, then you can find out a little bit more about that kind of snail. I'm kind of suspecting they are, especially if they're football-shaped.
Maybe if she can snap a picture and email it to us.
That would be great, too. But those snails tend to be fairly small snails that eat a lot of plants. At least some kinds do. I would say that with your concern about the assassins eating the Australia killifish eggs, it could happen, but I have a lot of assassin snails in this 55 right here, and I've got a lot of rainbow fish eggs in the spawning mops, and they don't seem to bother them. And that's not a guarantee that the assassin snails won't bother your fish, but I don't think it's going
to
be that big of a problem.
Maybe they won't be interested in the eggs so much.
Well, and they'll probably go for the snails first anyway. But they may not even bother the eggs that much. And even if they do, I would say put in like one or maybe three assassin snails, between one and three. Let them eat snails, see how they do, see how the eggs are doing. And you can always take assassin snails out. They're a lot easier to take out than other snails. So maybe just try it until you get rid of those snails. And one thing is, those snails may be eating your fish eggs too, because most snails are pretty opportunistic and most of them love snail eggs or fish eggs. So if you do have those snails in there, they may already be decimating your killifish eggs, possibly. So if you just put one in and see how it does, and then maybe increase it, and then after a couple of months of them eating them, you can just take them out, and that could help. As far as the betta goes, I think your worries are a bit founded. I think they could be a problem with these other bright fish, possibly. And you never know with bettas. They're sort of wild cards. They're so different, so variable. Some bettas will eat snails, and others will completely ignore them. You never know.
So it's probably not worth the risk to try it with the betta.
Right. And they probably pick off some of the endlers fry if you're breeding endlers in there. So at best, they'd probably do that. You did have a question about your red cherry shrimp doing okay in that system. And I do have red cherry shrimp that coexist with the assassin snails and the rainbow fish. They breed in there. They're not in huge numbers because I'm sure the rainbow fish are picking some off, and it's possible the assassin snails are picking some off, but they're still reproducing and growing up, and they're doing okay. I did read one article that said that assassin snails might hunt cherry shrimp, but I've also heard that a mono shrimp will eat cherry shrimp on occasion, and I haven't noticed a big problem in the tank. Like I said, there's a decent population doing fine in there.
Okay.
And then what's our next one?
David.
Okay. Well, let's we're going to have to save some of this because there's a lot, and we're glad there's a lot. Let's just cover this first one real quick. David from Texas had an idea. He had a lot, but one of them was about freshwater live rock. Why don't we do it more often? Who does it? You know, those kinds of things. Excuse me. Now, one thing that I'd like to mention is that I think that's a great idea. I think freshwater live rock makes a lot of sense. And of course, it has some differences from saltwater live rock. And for those of you who don't know about saltwater live rock, basically it is coral rubble that has been sitting in the ocean and getting all sorts of interesting critters living on it. But also, that's important, it's porous because it's based on coral and it's got bacteria living in it. And the bacteria are a type of biofiltration for the tank. They help keep it healthy, and you've got different kinds of bacteria that live on the surface and different kinds that live on in the inside, but it helps metabolize a lot of wastes. It also introduces interesting life into your aquarium, too. So, There are three things that this makes me think of, and I actually learned a lot of these from listening to Pet Fish Talk, too, myself. But I've applied some of them. There's a product called an EcoBioBlock. I don't get any money for saying this, and I've never tried the product myself. But basically, that's what it is. It's kind of a freshwater live rock, where these porous stones, I think they're made from volcanic rock that has been in an aggregate, and then they kind of press it together. Pretty sure that's how they make it, if I recall correctly. And they were developed for reclamation of natural bodies of water. And then
they absorb impurities and nastiness?
They've got nice bacteria in them that help purify. And because they've got all that surface area and the different types of bacteria on the outside and inside.
Area.
Exactly. So they were developed to reclaim these natural bodies of water in Japan, and then they started using them in aquariums, and they've got different types. Some that have buffers in them for large, large ponds, and some that don't for aquariums, and different shapes and so on. But anyway, those might be worth a look into as a type of freshwater live rock, because I think that's basically the idea behind them. And then there are lava rock trickle filters that people build for ponds and tanks and so on, where they basically take a big plastic container and some sort of filter pad material to run the water through, and then the rest of the water runs through a lot of lava rock. And you get all sorts of interesting bacterial action going on there, both outside and inside the rock, because on the inside there's not that much oxygen. On the outside there's a lot of oxygen, so you get both aerobic and anoxic conditions, and probably anaerobic conditions far enough in the rock. And you get bacteria that take care of nitrate, but also bacteria that take care of nitrite. I said that backwards. You get bacteria that take care of ammonia and nitrite on the outsides, bacteria that take care of nitrate on the insides, if you do it right. And then, just adding lava rock to aquariums, I do that. I think it works fairly well. In most of my aquariums, I have some lava rock, and I think it helps with those, the bacteria that take care of nitrate on the insides. So on, to some degree, and that's what my Opiula tanks work on, and it seems to work really well. I don't have to do water changes very often. I do them, but I don't need to do them very often, and the system seems to stay in pretty good balance because of all that lava rock. So, that's brackish water, live rock, I guess, but sort of the same principle. So we'll talk about some of these other things that David from Texas brought up. He's got a lot of great ideas and interesting questions. And thank you to all of our contributors
we'll talk about them
today.
Next time.
Yes, we'll talk about those next time. Thank you to all of our contributors today. And please keep it up. We love it. We noticed that our people who like us on Facebook, our numbers going up.
Yay.
So thank you for doing that. And any way that you contribute is most welcome and in any quantity. So feel free to speak up, email us, call us, whatever you want to do. We're happy.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.